So, well, Kyle, welcome to the podcast, man. I appreciate you making the time. It's nice to see you. You're on the East Coast. Hopefully it's warmer there than it is here.
Still pretty cold, Todd. Thanks for having me, though. But, you know, it's warmer than yesterday, so we'll take it.
That's good. Well, good. Well, let's dig into it. I know we're a little short on time, but I'm curious about just maybe your background. I looked at it, and it's like one of the things I thought was pretty interesting was you have a wide range of kind of sales, marketing, some operational experience, and then obviously kind of the investment side of it, which I think makes you really uniquely kind of qualified to kind of talk about startup-related stuff. And so I'm pretty excited to hear about that. But maybe give me a quick intro, maybe a couple minutes on just how you got here.
Yeah, great. So great to have be here today, and thanks for having me on. So I'm CEO and managing partner of York IE, and we're an advisory and venture capital firm that wouldn't be possible without my background. You know, I grew up in a small Main Street small business. I ended up going to undergrad business school, and right away, luckily, I got internships in software and technology. And first jobs were marketing. I kind of moved into sales when I realized I had some of that natural DNA. And, yep. Spent 7 years in my first startup, which was an education software startup.
Okay.
I had moved to California. I was traveling all around North America. We sold K-12 private school software to run the schools. It was my first company. Yep. But actually, a high school classmate had moved a small little startup called Dyne from Worcester, Massachusetts, back up to New Hampshire in my hometown of Manchester, New Hampshire. And the company was called Dyne. And turns out it was kind of a good opportunity, and they were looking for somebody to be the, I always say, the co-founder they never had, the sales, marketing, business growth person to complement super technical product and engineering co-founders. And I joined that company 2008. And from 2008 to late 2016, we scaled to 100 million of annual recurring revenue. It was a SaaS business that specialized in internet infrastructure. The domain name system was our core expertise in technology. And a lot of people who aren't technical may not have known of Dyne and know DNS, but for those listening, we powered everything from CNN.com to the NewYorkTimes.com to Twitter, Netflix, Airbnb, Uber. If you were a fast growth global web brand, you probably leveraged some sort of Dyne technology along the way. That great experience as a chief revenue officer, running sales, marketing, BD, corp dev, customer success, led to our acquisition by Oracle. So Oracle was a client and partner of ours over many years, and developed a great relationship with them, and were able to land inside Oracle for a heck of an outcome for everybody involved. And then I spent a few years inside Oracle. So, I've been in the early stage, small, scrappy bootstrap startup. I've been in the venture-backed startup. I've been, in a private equity, growth equity startup. And then I've worked in Big Red, which is quite a behemoth. So a lot of operational experience. And then just quickly in parallel to that, I started to advise and sit on boards and angel invest along the way. And all with this lens of like my operational background. And I started to pool capital with other operators and build different investment vehicles. And I was doing that all moonlighting with this dream that someday I would maybe build this advisory venture capital firm I'm now building.
And here you are.
Here we are. Yeah. So it's like all very easy and hand wavy, but a heck of a run.
Yeah, well, that's cool. It seems like there's a lot of parallels for me. I worked at Concur, and I was there pretty early. So I was there maybe the 40th employee, and then basically left in 2016. And we were about $1.2 billion in revenue, and we sold to SAP for $8.3 billion. So, I did the acquisition thing for a couple of years. It was a little jarring. I'm sure yours was jarring too in a different way. Just, like large organizations, a lot of independence before, and then you've got somebody you answer to. So it was a good experience for me, but I only did 2 years. And then I was out.
I beat you by 1 year, but that was probably only made possible because, when we sold the business, we were about 500 employees, but the group that bought us was called Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. It's called OCI, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure now, akin to AWS and Microsoft Azure and GCP. They were only 300 when they bought us. So we almost had this like, I wouldn't call it by any stretch a reverse merger or anything, but we ended up in pretty senior roles in a joint org that ballooned to almost 10,000 people over the run we were there. And yeah, I'd say for, the majority of it, 2 years, 11 months, or 2 years stuff was really actually like a really well-funded startup inside a large organization.
Yep.
It was once it
yep.
became substantial is when we dealt with all the, oh boy, they're going to integrate yep. everything. They,
right.
we're getting a lot more process and, it just was like, okay, white towel waved, maybe it's time to go.
Exactly. Yeah. Was Mark Nelson there when you were there? Did you know Mark Nelson? He was at Oracle.
That name doesn't ring a bell. What org was he in? Sales?
He was in development. He was on the development side in cloud infrastructure early. He was our CTO for a while.
Okay, yeah.
He was based
I
out of Seattle.
Came across him. Yeah, if he's out of Seattle, then yeah. I mean, I reported directly to Don Johnson, who came out of AWS. But yeah, I mean, it got big fast, and it kind of like, there was also multiple iterations of Oracle Cloud. Like I think we were called Gen 2 Cloud because there was like a kind of miss. It's obviously giant, right? I mean, I think at the time we were there, it was a couple hundred thousand people holistically.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's a fun run. It's fun to compare some stories. So let's pivot a little bit to kind of maybe your philosophy on, you've taken all this experience and now you look at startups and stuff. And I think you and I are probably in the same boat. We look at a lot of startups, but execution is really king, right? Like that's basically at the end of the day, right? Good idea, great. But unless you can actually put the pieces together and prioritize the right things to focus on at the right time, you ain't gonna move the needle. And so I think, as I was doing some research for this, I think your kind of understanding of the customer problem, this one's a key for us. I think that so many people build products that nobody wants to buy. Like they think it's interesting, but they're not willing to change their behavior or to actually pay you to go do it. And so maybe talk a little bit about your kind of philosophy on this, because I think it's a key component where like it's a do not go forward if you can't figure this problem out.
Yeah. So we call that the market in approach to company building. I think what you tend to see a lot, especially with technical founders, engineering founders, is that, like you said, they know they can build it, and they might have a hypothesis on why, but maybe haven't, analyze the market, the competitors, the comparators. Where's the funding going? Are the big players doing it? Are the small players doing it? Like, you still need there to be a market to disrupt, right? And you've seen over the years, a lot of times the winners of markets end up being the ones who are third, fourth, fifth, place in the beginning or sequentially, or, and that really just comes down to timing and market execution, as you discussed. So we call that the market in approach, right, to company building. And then I think secondly, it's like so many technical founders, especially in tech, like don't talk to customers, right? It's like creating those alpha and those beta programs, like letting customers inform or your product roadmap, or even bringing on customers as design partners to help you build your applications in the early days to really find that. You really need to, even if you're building a platform, you need to find that wedge that's the repeatable early use case that enables you to start to hopefully bring on customer funding, is what I like to call it.
Revenue. People are paying.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine such a thing. So that's one side of it. I think the second side of it that we've started to see emerge over the last few years, and I'd love your perspectives on this too, we've started to see a lot more vertical software, vertical SaaS get created where it's not technical founders building SaaS applications, but it is like domain and industry experts coming into technical companies to build technologies and platforms to disrupt their markets. It kind of has like a very akin issue though, where the domain expert in the supply chain industry or the fishing industry or the agriculture industry may not have the software SaaS metrics, KPIs, go to markets, technical competencies to understand actually even how to organize or to prioritize how to build product and bring them to market. And so those are I'd say the commonality of like the two founders that we work with, either in our advisory as a service offerings or that we invest in. They kind of like look like one or the other, right? Like industry founder, deep domain expertise, business oriented, or technical. And we try to bring in our advisory platform, we have R&D capabilities, go to market support capabilities, and G&A capabilities. And no two companies are created equal in what they might need help on. We obviously have to bob and weave and scope appropriately for what companies need.
So I think it's good. I think there's a lot of commonality the way we see it. I think vertical SaaS is kind of where we're at too. I think that we're looking for founders that basically will go deep in their area, and maybe they don't have a technical background, maybe they don't have a sales background. And what we're trying to do is provide maybe more technical just tools along the way to help them, right? And so I think that the tools have gotten so much better, even in the no-code solution to get you an MVP, right? Totally. And so we've got people that are basically saying, I'll spend, you know, $7,000 to $12,000 to get something that will get me 1,000 customers on the platform. And then once I know I got a real business, fine, I can redo it. Right. Or like there's people that just don't know email marketing, right? Like all the steps you have to go to anymore. Like we're stitching all that together to say, look, we'll help you do that. You still got to understand the messaging. You got to understand the drip campaign, but like you don't need to understand how to, you know, do like burner domains, warm up the domain. Right. You don't have to like figure out how to go Google to Google and Apple, you know, like you have to figure all that stuff out. And then the last piece that we've been working on too is how do you build sales agents that basically gives them some discipline that says, pick a methodology for sales, but then let's help you coach you to say, you're not selling your features, you're doing discovery, right? You see so many founders that basically just want to like throw up and say, look at this wonderful product I've built. Really what they should be doing is saying, what's the biggest problem that you have? And if I could solve it, does that really give you the value proposition you're looking for? And will you buy? And so I think like driving more discipline and more training wheels to a deep domain knowledge founder to basically validate, do you have a business or not? We deal with really early people. But I think it's very similar to your philosophy.
Yeah, it is. No, and I think it's ironic, right? I mean, we've just lived through 20 years of the growth at all costs model of companies raising, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of valuation or dollars at valuations that are insane, right? Yep. In a world where everything's moving towards automation and AI and efficiency, you know, outside of like the COVID bump, I think we've now been like corrected appropriately in the venture and startup technology arena, that it can actually capitalize on the things you're talking about, right? Because I think boards and VCs are all starting to think more like, how are you more efficient? Like, how do you truly have a path to profitability? How do you manage the growth? You know, and across our companies, you know, we kind of view it like, it's okay to like raise money and go for it if you've earned the right to raise money and go for it. But also don't just spend to spend. If you can be efficient and effective and, you know, whether you're lowering your CAC or you're lowering your COGS or you're increasing your gross margin or you're extending your runway, like obviously you should leverage technologies to do so. The other thing that's funny, like in some of these vertical industries, like they don't need to be AI platforms in these industries. They just need to bring software and get people out of pen and paper or out of Excel spreadsheets.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean they can't leverage AI inside their operation to be more efficient and effective at operating their business and scaling their business, right? So that's something that we wrestle with a lot because, you know, a lot of like LP dollars are moving towards funds that are saying they're the next big thing in AI or cybersecurity. And those markets are still really wildly frothy from the fundraises and the valuations. But a lot of these industries don't need like bleeding edge stuff yet. If they had bleeding edge stuff, they wouldn't get adopted by their factory floor buyer.
That's
right?
Exactly.
So it's this interesting balancing act that we see, and we like to have a diverse portfolio of engagements that gives us a little taste everywhere, but you know, also is as pragmatic as it gets.
It's kind of interesting. I guess there's a couple of pieces that I would overlay on it. For us, we kind of like have this idea that like there's a lot of room between a lifestyle business and a $1 billion business. And I think a lot of people just kind of forget about the middle of the space. And then I think that if you can basically find a niche that's pretty good and you sell for 60, 70, 200 million, and you didn't raise much capital and you were capital efficient, your returns look pretty good, right? You could basically, you're not getting non-dilutional. You're not basically getting a bunch of these, you're not losing control. Maybe everybody's the same common shareholders. There's lots of benefits to do it. And your returns, both for their investor as well as the entrepreneur is fine. And so to me, there is a little bit of a rewiring in some of this where you're basically, to your point, you don't have to go after the stuff that's super sexy. In a lot of cases, I want the stuff that's like kind of boring and like, you know, like we even look at like things in precision ag, like we're in an ag world. You got all these people on the backside of precision ag that do nothing with the data. They don't understand what to do with it. So there's a whole bunch of products there. The same thing with machinists. We had a machinist come to us and then we were like shocked at all the stuff they do manually on the shop floor. Right. Or the guy Earl, who's been here for like manufacturing, who's been here for like 30 years, he's retiring next week. And you like all that domain just goes out the door. And so there are so many opportunities.
You'll get a laugh out of some of the industries we're in, you know, like shellfish traceability, produce agriculture, You know, like it's, it, you know, it kind of runs the gamut, you know, it's, and you're spot on. And I think that's what we don't need to be domain experts in agriculture or shellfish, right? That's what these folks are bringing. What we need to help them is build yep. products, technology, capability, also the business side, the go-to-market side of their businesses. And I think it's an incredibly exciting time. And I think the correction was a good thing. I'm prolific on LinkedIn and Twitter. I always post blogs, all this stuff. I've had two viral tweets, okay? One was I like watched the Folklore documentary on Taylor Swift, and I just like posted uh-huh. like, great documentary if you haven't seen it on Disney Plus. And it woke up the next day and I was like, holy cow, I'm a Swiftie, right? The second was I wrote something like, you know, a startup exit of 25 million, 50 million, 75 million is a life-changing event, but the VC and technology world is to minimize this exit. That's a damn shame. And, you know, yep. went to bed next day, like, whoa, right? But it's exactly how I feel. I mean, some of the best outcomes I've had as an investor have been, or an advisor have been, just getting in early, taking a risk, yep. getting it at the right entry valuation, companies who are prudent about their capital strategies, who don't just dilute you to hell every freaking time, yep. you know, and have good 25, 50, $100 million exits. Like, and by the way, for the founder, life-changing generational wealth. Right. Yeah. And I get that maybe a VC made a 1.5 times or a VC made a 2 times or a 1x return. But usually for the founder, they're in pretty damn good shape at those exits. And I think we got to get back to that. Right. The founders are the ones who are actually building the companies. Let's make sure yeah. that they feel it, feel the love and feel the reward.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is just like the status, right? It's not like about how much money you take. It's not about the valuation that you do. It's about like doing the math of saying, what is that that intergenerational wealth that I can create totally. Without doing all that, right?
We call that metrics. It's like, right. why did all the vanity That's exactly metrics it. Get celebrated? And I remember after we sold Dyn, our exit was to Oracle, our exit was $600 million. And there's a company called Simplivity that was, you know, I think HP might have bought them. I don't recall exactly, but it was like a 600, you know, 25, you know, million or 650 million investment. And it was right in New England, where, you know, right in Boston, only like 45 minutes south of me. And I remember getting a few notes like, oh, you must be annoyed that they, you know, were a bigger deal in Boston area than you. And I said, guys, their last valuation round was at 1.2 billion and they've raised like over $100 million. Yeah. Like we win, you know, yes. but again, the headline number makes them look like they were a better exit. Right. And again, I'm not demeaning anyone involved in that situation, but it just is the land we play in. It celebrates like kind of things that don't really matter. Right. So I don't know. I'm with you entirely on that, Todd.
Yeah. So we got about 10 minutes left. I'm curious on, let's talk about AI a little bit, because I think it's changing the landscape. It's changing the entrepreneur opportunity. It's crashing a lot of things. And it's going to be massively disruptive. I mean, I really feel like it's the trend line for the next 20 years for my career, right? Like if I want to continue to do this, like that is the through line for a lot of stuff. I think the tools are coming out. I think people are confused about how to use it. You know, some of the stuff that I did from a research perspective, you talk about how to use kind of AI and even product strategy. And it's not like just, and I think what I have been concerned about in some cases is people just bolting on an API to like basically or an existing workflow process, right? And so yep. a lot of what you want to see from founders is go back to first principles, understand how this workflow actually should work. Well, CRM is a great, you know, example of that. You know, Salesforce has built a huge business on this, right? And so it's a workflow productivity tool. But if right. you could reinvent that with a read AI or something that was taking that information and populating it for you, like you could redo the whole thing. And so I'm just kind of curious on like, are you seeing founders start to like look at that and say, this is not how the process is, and just making it a little bit better by pumping and building something on top of it, but rethinking from the beginning of what's this product strategy really look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a loaded question. I don't know which angle to take. I mean, I think there's so much hype and buzz in the AI movement, and it's deserved and earned, and I am bullish as all bullish. I think there's layers, like in anything else, of the stack, just like there were in like the SaaS movement or the cloud movement or the .NET movement or the internet movement sure. before, right? And there's like deep infrastructure layer, and those are the companies that are, you know, require immense, ridiculous
billions
funding.
Of dollars.
I think you recently saw Stargate announced that says $500 billion, right?
Yeah.
Right. But then there's like a lot of tools at the very tippity top of the stack that are apps or, you know, plugins or layered on technologies that are more in that kind of workflow world, right? What I look for is I think AI is only as powerful as the data it's being fed. And if you don't have unique and proprietary data and or access to unique and proprietary data married with domain expertise and prompts to coordinate that data and create outputs and prescriptive, proactive, action-oriented behaviors, then like, what's the point, right? So I think that's one core point. The second thing for me is I hate how everyone's just buying like a .ai domain and like turning what was software and automation and algorithms to call
an
it
AI
all
company.
AI, right? Mm-hmm. Like an AI company. Like I like when I review pitches and I'm like, okay, here's how they're incorporating AI into their feature set, either for expansion of engagement or usage or for retention of their product or for innovation of their product. I don't want you to like reinvent the wheel and necessarily launch something entirely new. Because as we discussed earlier, not every industry's buyer is ready for all this like wild sophistication or innovation at the bleeding edge of AI, right?
Sure.
So incorporating, I want everyone to have an answer of how they're incorporating AI into their application. I want everyone to have an answer of how they're incorporating AI into their operations, their business operations, their go-to-market, their product development cycles, like all customer feedback loops, CS. But I don't necessarily want to see everybody reinvent the wheel, right? Now, with that said, when you work across a portfolio, one of our biggest high flyers is a company called Cranium that is an AI business that's cybersecurity on your language learning models for large enterprises to make sure that they're compliant, that they're regulated, right? Like, so like there are like plays we're making, and then we have others like Canvas.ai that is a market research tool for consumer brands to measure emotional cues and sentiment in open-ended text responses to product reviews and surveys and things like that. So there are plays where it like makes a heck of a lot of sense, but I think the student body shift of everybody running that direction that maybe isn't even relevant to their buyer or their industry yet, or is a complete like shift in their business, is a little bit too far afoot, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think what resonates too is, we go back to the vertical SaaS and the domain expertise, having the data that's unique across, like most of these are horizontal models. And so they're only trained on public stuff. And so if you've got something that's proprietary and you can basically build inference with it, then basically you have a much more value to add to your workflow or to whatever problem you're doing. I'm curious if your clients and stuff are using, Llama, like DeepSeek just came out, they're performing really well. Their licensing is even more generous probably than Llama is. It just seems like places like OpenAI are paying the price for innovation, and they're paying a lot of money, and then it's getting democratized extremely quickly with these open source tools. And it's just interesting to see. Our companies are starting to use those tools and saying they're good enough.
Totally. That's absolutely with us. And it's so the way that we build our advisory as a service offering is we build technology and automation and leverage AI to deliver more efficiently to clients. And then we have 170 employees at our India operations center, full-time employees at York IE India. And those things are one and the same almost in how we deliver. Yep. And so we've built a lot of our own proprietary tools that are merging publicly available data, to your point, with proprietary data like market assessments, market rationales, watch lists, deeper research across domains and industries, right? I think you're right. It's the marriage of both that makes it really powerful. But also I think you're right. Like there's so many tools that are going to come, that are going to be open source, that are going to get hot, that developers are going to rather work with, that are going to be more cost effective. They're going to have different models. And that's where I've lived this, right? So have you. Like we've lived through different stages of this, internet driven technology adoption.
Yep.
And it's
mobile,
it's mobile. I mean, it's everywhere. And I think, and that exists in different vertical segments and at different layers of the stack. And we've seen time and time again that no industry is really ever one player, right? And I always used to say this all the time at Dyn. They'd be like, how do you compete with Microsoft? And how do you compete with Google? And how do you compete with Amazon? How do you compete with Oracle? I'm like, well, their friends, their foes, their partners. There's enough pie. Like it's a big enough industry and market where I can still build a successful company and career to impact the world that I don't need to be Microsoft or Google, you know? And I feel that way now in venture and advisory. I don't need to be McKinsey or Bain. I can aspire to be like them. I don't need to be Andreessen Horowitz or Y Combinator. I can aspire to be like them. But there's enough of a universe in tech startups for all of us to do really well. I'm sure you feel the same way. And I think that's what happens is the Silicon Valley culture is like winner takes all, growth at all costs. And I just find that all to be so nonsensical to the reality of the entrepreneur who's hustling out here.
Yeah, totally agree with you. There's so much pie. And I think it just goes back to our thesis we keep talking about. Like, there's a lot of space between a lifestyle business and a $1 billion business and these domain expertise. Like, you can build really good businesses that will create intergenerational wealth for you and your investors. And so, fine, I'm happy to play in that pool. So with a couple of minutes left, I mean, like what advice would you give to like early stage founders, right? You see a ton of this stuff. You've been through a number of these cycles. What are one or two kind of good takeaways that you think like entrepreneurs that you see maybe fail to like recognize early?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think founder market fit is super, super, super important. I see a lot of founders come to me with their idea or their company, and they have zero relevancy that they can point back to through their career trajectory to even be doing what they're doing. It's mind blowing to me how often this happens, right? Like someone comes to me who built a great app in MarTech and all of a sudden they want to like disrupt medicine. You're like, why and how, right? So that's number one. Number two, I think that focus on like brand building and customer adoption really early. I see way too many companies have no right being stealth. Always like, I don't get it. Like, I get that you might be figuring out your product and your MVP, but you have a vision, you have a mission, you have a problem solution statement. Like, tell the world about it, build community, build fanfare, talk to people, get feedback. Again, that market in approach, that's what drives innovation. That's what drives relevancy. And that's what drives an actual healthy foundation of a business, right? So I think those are the two things that I've been obsessing over more recently.
Well, that's good. Good. Well, I'm going to be sensitive to your time. I really appreciate this conversation. I think you and I could probably riff for a while. We probably could have had a beer and had a really good time. So maybe we'll continue this conversation sometime. But I really appreciate you sharing your insights and kind of your journey, because I think there's a lot of great takeaways for our entrepreneurs in this. So thank you very much, Kyle. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Okay.